Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. My guest today is Timothy A. Wise, Senior Advisor at IATP, Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, where his work focuses on agribusiness, family farmers, and the future of food, based on his recent book, Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food. Tim has a long history of collaboration with IATP on issues including agricultural dumping, U.S. agricultural subsidies, and policies and responses to the 2007-08 global food crisis, the WTO, and Mexico under NAFTA. He was a senior advisor with the Small Planet Institute, where he directed the Land and Food Rights Program from 2016 to 2020.
Tim, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's great to be back with you.
Yes, I want to tell you that your book, Eating Tomorrow, had a big impact on me. It's funny to call it one of my favorite things that I've read because the information in it is profound and not necessarily positive, talking about humans and how we treat each other and the planet. And we'll get into that a lot, I hope, during this program. But I reached out to you for two reasons. You sent your list an email about a report that came out a few months ago called False Promises, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. And you contributed to that piece. It's about 40 pages. And then you had an article recently in the Interpress?
On Interpress Service, yeah.
Interpress Service, yes. And that reminded me about the False Promises report, and I wanted to talk to you about it. So first of all, this is COVID-19 times. How are you and how's your family and everyone you love?
Doing better than most, feeling in a way, you know, lucky in the pandemic and hoping for greater progress and leadership.
Right. You're in Massachusetts?
In Massachusetts, yeah. Where we've done a somewhat better job than some other parts of the country, but it is striking that as an international development researcher, I am no longer welcome almost anywhere in the world because I'm from the United States and we are the problem.
We are the problem. It's feeling very claustrophobic right now with the borders closed. To talk about the current moment, even here in the United States, in addition to COVID-19, we have wildfires raging along the West Coast. We have friends and family out there, and it's just horrifying to read about what's going on. And we're pretty much the cause of a lot of the problems that are going on today. And in the headline, we don't read what we're going to talk about right now, at least not enough. We've got political topics going on. The pandemic with coronavirus has gotten a lot of press. Climate change is kind of eking up again because of the wildfires. But let's talk about food. This program is called It's All About Food. And there's so much around the world that is connected to food, distribution, injustice, inequality, destruction of the planet, false promises. Tell me about that report.
Well, in the research for my book, Eating Tomorrow, about half of the book is about Africa. I spent time in Southern Africa, in Mozambique, Malawi, Zambia, Tanzania. And I was struck in that research what a mismatch there was between the policies being followed by governments and by donor agencies, meaning government donors to agricultural development, and also philanthropic donors like the Gates Foundation. What a mismatch there was between the policies they were following and the policies that farmers wanted, small-scale farmers wanted and needed as they faced climate change. I became more aware that the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa wasn't the most important funder of all of this work, but it was certainly the driver of the narrative. And I wanted to understand better, not just at a country case study level, but at a broader level, what kind of impact all of that money and all of that push to get farmers to use commercial seeds and fertilizers as a means of boosting yields, incomes, and food security, what impact it was having. And so this was an updating of some research that we'd done for the book.
History repeats itself, right? So we've done this before. We've done this in the United States, in other countries, and now decades later, we see the damage to our soil health, soil diversity, to yields. We see how it has impacted global warming because of our need to use petrochemical fertilizers, synthetic fertilizers. And yet we want to share this with other countries like Africa in order to increase their yields and to increase their incomes when we know it doesn't work.
Well, we know it doesn't work. And it's interesting that in the course of doing this research and talking about it, I've referred—
Now, when you say we, who is we?
The U.S. promoters of these policies, okay, and the companies that promote these policies and benefit from them. The Green Revolution, and the first Green Revolution, the one that took place mainly in India and other parts of Asia and to some extent Latin America, is still widely touted as a success in development circles. You go to environmental circles and it's decried as a complete disaster. You go to the places where it took place, like India, and it's being widely rejected now. There are whole states in India that were the focus of Green Revolution programs, the promotion of commercial seeds and fertilizers and other technologies to increase yields of rice and wheat in that case. And they're just running as fast as they can away, trying to undo the damage caused to their soils, to their water, to their aquifers, and to small-scale farmers who, you know, again, started out seeing some benefits and then very quickly started seeing that they were in debt. So I kind of refer to that, to the new Green Revolution for Africa, as the failed policies of the past. It was sold to Africa by the Gates Foundation and others as Africa lost out on the first Green Revolution for a variety of reasons, but now we have the technologies to bring Africa its own special, personalized, ecologically specific set of seeds and fertilizers, like it was all new and improved. And, you know, the more I looked at it, the more I saw that, yeah, they can get a whole lot more seed varieties produced faster. Sure, they can tailor their commercial seeds to different ecological regions. But the main difference, the biggest difference between the first Green Revolution and this one, is that the biggest impact of the first Green Revolution was irrigation. And the African Green Revolution isn't doing anything with that. So I joke in the book that, like many tech innovations and upgrades, the Green Revolution 2.0 had a lot of nice, new, pretty features, but it left out some of the features that turned out to be the most useful and that the consumers themselves might have appreciated, like irrigation. But the reason it was sold that way, and I think it's important to put it in that context, is that Africa, you know, is a growing population. It's still overwhelmingly agricultural, and the yields are relatively low. Productivity is relatively low. Food insecurity is high. They came in with the food price crisis of 2007 and 8. People might not remember that, but in what we mainly experienced in the U.S. as a financial crisis, a piece of that was a commodities crisis. And mm-hmm. So there were shortages or perceived shortages of commodities, a lot of speculation, a lot of run-up in international prices, and a scare that, oh my God, we have hit that Malthusian wall where we're not going to be able to, the resources are not going to sustain our growing populations. The Gates Foundation and the Green Revolution for Africa was there with the ready-made answer to African countries: you want to grow more of your own food? Here's how you should do it. And that, I think, is partly why they got so much traction. That and the amount of money they put into it. It's $1 billion so far put into Agra.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, just for a moment. Bill Gates, especially, is getting a lot of attention, especially in alternative circles, the anti-vax circle, alternative health circles. And there are conspiracy theories. I don't buy into any of these, but he's getting a bad rap about the things that he promotes. And some of the things I've read are really far-fetched, but this is not far-fetched. It's true. My question is, why would he and his organization want to do this sort of project? Are they not aware of what the ecologists are aware of? I would think that they would be. What I want to say is, I don't want to believe there's an evil motivating factor behind this African Green Revolution.
I mean, your question is the one I've gotten asked in every single book talk I've ever given since my book came out last year, because everybody goes, wow, does Gates know this?
Yeah.
Like, that this isn't working. I don't quite know. I kind of dodged the question in a way, because I'm a researcher and motivations aren't really my intent. And reading personal intent is really not something. I mean, I tried to get interviews with the Gates Foundation, got one very not very helpful interview with someone at the Gates Foundation. They're very protective of their image. It's very hard to get a sense of what's going on.
You need to talk to Bill, Tim.
Yeah. But that's the thing. It's like everybody says that. I don't think there's any reason to believe that me or anybody else talking to Bill or me or anyone else getting my book in Bill's hands would change the equation. And one person who knows that situation better was involved actually in consulting with the foundation when it set up its agricultural program in 2006. His answer to the question is, it's probably unreasonable to think that a technology monopolist from Microsoft is going to be in favor of solutions to the world's problems that don't involve technology and big corporations.
Yeah.
That's who he is, that's what he does. I think what's striking about this, I say that not as in any way to excuse the Gates Foundation from accountability for this. And in fact, we did this study precisely because we thought there was a phenomenal lack of accountability going on from AGRA, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, and from the Gates Foundation and the other donors that are supporting it. Because, I mean, to summarize briefly what we found in this, you know, so AGRA set out with very ambitious goals. They were working mainly in 13 countries, and their goal was to double productivity and incomes for 30 million small-scale farming households while cutting food security in half by 2020. So we said, here we are in 2020. What does the data show? We contacted Gates. They wouldn't provide any, the foundation wouldn't provide any data. They sent us to AGRA. They said, we just fund them. They're not our, it's not our project. AGRA initially said they would provide data from their monitoring and evaluation work on their impacts. And then they went silent after a month. And I think they clearly got the word from on high, don't cooperate with critical researchers. So we use national level data for those 13 countries to basically just say, okay, is there any sign of these things happening, right? Is there any sign that productivity is going up at that doubling? Is there any sign that incomes are going up for rural people? Is there any sign of food security improving? And the results are just damning for AGRA and for any of the funders who support it. And Gates has provided 2/3 of the funding, over $600 million since the beginning. The results were yields have gone up, not 100%, that would be double, 18%, and not faster than it was before AGRA started. Yield growth was almost as fast before AGRA started. Incomes, poverty remains endemic throughout the region. And the most damning number, I think, is the food security number. The FAO does estimates over time of the number of people they categorize as undernourished. That's their category for sort of extreme hunger. And the number of undernourished people in those 13 countries has gone up 31%, not gone down 50%. That's failure by any measure. And it's failure, and I, as an economist by training, it's a failure. It's a massive failure when you think about the amounts of money being put into this project, because it's not just the Gates Foundation. It's not just AGRA. It's that African governments have been putting $1 billion a year into subsidizing the purchase of these inputs, of these commercial seeds and fertilizers. Poor cash-strapped African governments are wasting their money on these things. So we think there's a real accountability gap, and we really hope that this report shines a light on that and makes African citizen groups demand that their governments account for whether these things are working and helping smallholders and use their money better.
These governments are putting in a lot of money, and they're putting in more money than they're getting from foundations. So it's, in some ways, it's like they're investing so that they can get discounts on products that ultimately don't even work.
I think that's right. And they,
benefiting though.
Having done a lot of research and talked to a lot of government representatives in Southern Africa for my book, I'm actually very sympathetic to their plight. And the people working in those agriculture ministries, I found a lot of really smart people, really dedicated people, really concerned people, because they kind of see that this isn't working. And they see that, I mean, an interesting example was this guy, a really interesting guy in Malawi who recently passed away, unfortunately. Namaona was the head of planning. And he was the first one who said to me, you know, I worry about a yield plateau in Malawi. And so a yield plateau is something that's pretty well established in agronomy. It's basically the first fertilizers you apply to a field of corn are going to dramatically increase the yields of that corn. But over time, if you keep growing corn on that land and you keep using the same fertilizers on that land and you don't do anything else for that land, yields are going to flatten out. You're not going to keep getting big yield increases. And in fact, you're going to need to apply more and more fertilizer to get the same yields, just to maintain yields. That's the yield plateau. And he was the first one who said, you know, look at the data. We've been pushing these things. Malawi has probably one of the largest input subsidy programs, subsidizing these inputs, or they have had one of the largest. And he said, it's not working. It's not sustainable.
Not working. It's not sustainable.
It worked for a few years, and it's not sustainable.
One of the goals was that the farmers would double their income.
That's right. They're going to double their income. And again, there's just...
The math isn't there because of all of these variable costs.
It's the insane idea too, just again, from straight up economics, that if you double yields, you're going to double incomes. Absolutely not. I mean, that presumes that all of that extra corn you grow, you can sell for a good price in the marketplace, a condition that almost never prevails in the field. If everybody is successfully growing more corn, the price goes down at harvest time and farmers get terrible prices for their corn. And it also presumes that they don't need to eat the corn. They're hungry people. If they can grow more corn, they probably are going to save it and eat it, not sell it. And so their incomes aren't going up. Maybe their food security would go up, but not their incomes. Anyway, it's just all the premises I wrote somewhere, that all the premises that Agra is based on have proven to be false.
That's just a major fail and just too incredible to believe. Here we are in 2020 and this is happening with all that we've learned over the decades, or at least some of us have learned. I've spent the last few decades in nonprofit management, and I've been involved with a number of nonprofits and going for different grants. And one of the things that's always necessary is you have to provide metrics and you have to do regular reporting and show, if you want to get more money, that your programs are working, that your programs are having an impact on a certain number of people that are in need and can benefit, blah, blah, blah. And I read this and I wonder, how does the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation get away with giving money, and what kind of metrics are they getting, or they don't care?
In my research, I've had people tell me that their accountability mechanisms within the foundation have historically been terrible.
Should try and apply for a grant with them.
Well, in a way that's true, because they're giving away so much money that they're looking for massive projects. They need massive projects. They don't even consider projects that are small. And they will often give them to organizations that then do subcontract a lot of small projects. I mean, for a foundation that prides itself on being science and evidence-based, right? We do what works is kind of their, you know, that's the Gates mantra. Mm-hmm. They have been impervious to evidence that this is failing. And they've made minor changes in their funding strategies within their agriculture program. I give them credit for some of those, like they switched to focusing on food crops not export crops. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. That's a big deal because there's always a push in international finance to get developing countries to grow more export crops for cash. But there seems to be no reconsideration of the basic efficacy of this particular approach.
So this program has focused on maize or corn, primarily.
Not only. It does a lot of different things. I mean, what it does is it promotes commodity crops that the rich countries have learned how to grow well and dominate in international markets. And in theory, they would say, we're bringing our comparative advantage to Africa in seed technologies and the like, so that you too can benefit. That's what they say to Africa. Africans view it as the new colonialism, as the imposition of
definitely
seed policies that open the doors to Monsanto and Bayer and multinational seed companies, and ultimately to undermining what African groups would call the peasant economy, the sort of core peasant economy, instead of helping peasant farmers grow their traditional foods better and improve their soils, which is what they most need. It's focused on, you know, the experts arrive and say, your seeds are terrible. Your soil won't produce anything. You need our seeds, and our fertilizers will make your soils grow those seeds. Abandon your seeds, abandon your practices, abandon your multiple cropping that gives them diet diversity mm-hmm. from cropping diversity in there. I saw that everywhere I went in Africa. And that's one of the more disturbing findings. And I was surprised it showed up so dramatically in the national level data. That all this push on maize and on rice is one of the other main crops they push, is real evidence of declining crop diversity. So you have traditional peasant crops that are pretty well adapted. They're sort of short season crops like millet, very high in nutritional value, useful for animals as well as people, grow well in a whole variety of different conditions. Very climate resilient. Millet production in agri-countries as a whole has gone down 24% in the same time in this agri-period. Yields have declined 21%. So that's just neglect by governments of investment in those crops and incentives to farmers to stop growing your millet and grow more maize because we have subsidies for you, because we have better seeds, because we have fertilizers. That aren't for your millet, they're for your maize.
I have a small nonprofit and I also work in the theater. I make very little money, but I prioritize my budget on organic plant foods. I'm a vegan, and especially during COVID-19, everything has been going to healthy organic food, and I'm fortunate and privileged to be able to have what I need. And I've been expanding my diversity, and reading your report, I was kind of chuckling to myself because I'm eating cassava products, cassava flour. Right. I'm eating more millet and sorghum. And we love our sweet potatoes, our tubers. Yep. I just feel like, what's happening here? I'm
those
learning.
Are all the crops that are going downhill under agri.
Exactly.
I mean, that's what the list shows. It's like stagnant yields and productivity and production for sorghum, stagnant or declining yields for millet. Roots and tubers as a category has been pretty stagnant. And the only one that's growing is the one that, within that category, the one that's growing most is the one that's promoted by these agencies, which is Irish potatoes. And Irish potatoes, which in theory are not a bad crop. They're pretty resilient and they could be good. Everywhere I went, they're mainly eaten as French fries. Mm. And so they're just, from a nutritional standpoint, what gains you're getting are just being robbed.
So I was wondering, with the focus on maize as on corn, how much of that is for human food? How much of it is for animals? And how much does it all go to people?
It's almost all for people. I mean, white corn is the staple crop of, one of the main staple crops of Southern and Eastern Africa. I mean, that comes out of its own whole colonial legacy, but corn isn't native to to Africa. It's native to the Americas and imported by Portugal and into the region. But it has become a staple, and it is overwhelmingly grown by small-scale farmers for their sustenance and by a smaller number of commercial producers for the urban market. It's eaten in the form of, in many places, it's called enchima. It's kind of like grits. It's cornmeal, ground into cornmeal, and produced as a kind of cake or porridge, depending on how thick it's prepared. And that really is the staple crop in a lot of countries. It's not a mistake. I push back against the people who demonize corn as a health disaster and an environmental disaster. It's actually, agronomically, it's considered the crop that probably is capable of producing, as a single crop, the most carbohydrates, meaning the most dietary energy per acre of land. It's a highly productive crop. The downside, and everyone I talk to in Southern Africa is worried about this, is the over-reliance on corn. That is that the diets have become way too corn-based and without adequate nutritional diversity coming from the kinds of crops that farmers used to grow and that used to be available in urban markets. And so,
but then we can genetically modify the corn and add the nutrients that they're missing, right?
Well, right. And indeed, one of my favorite projects in researching my book was this remarkable group of farmers, part of a project called the Malawi Farmer-to-Farmer Agroecology Project. They had found in their communities, one of the communities that they worked in, that some farmer was growing a bright orange variety of corn. Really striking. I'd been around a lot of corn, and I'd never seen anything quite like this. When you cooked it up into enchima, it was this almost iridescent orange corn, massively high in vitamin A and other nutrients. But vitamin A is a real deficiency that is commonly experienced in poor countries and often dealt with supplements, or GMO crowd will tell you, you need golden rice. A new crop had come on the market, which was fortified. So biofortified, which is not GMO. So fortification can be a useful tool. But they found working with a university that did a close nutritional study, that their native variety of orange corn had more bioavailable nutrients than the fortified one that was coming on the market. And of course, the government was promoting the biofortified one that was coming on the market. And when I asked the research director for the agriculture ministry, why not promote what grows here already and that has been proven to work? And he said, that's going to lose its vigor. The belief is, and this comes from the, not from agronomy, it comes straight out of the researchers and agricultural development people, is that local seeds go bad. Local seeds lose their productivity. Anyone who has studied this stuff knows that if that were true, we'd all be dead, right? For thousands of years, we sustained our societies on the basis of farmers saving seeds and actually improving them by selecting the best seeds every year. And so it was constant improvement, not constant erosion of productivity. And it's now the assumption is that local seeds just get worse and need to be replaced, basically.
We have the African Green Revolution Forum happening this week.
Yeah.
Are you participating? Or is this just for the...
Well, it's a virtual conference. I would have loved to have been there. This would have been an interesting year to do it because we have these findings and we're trying to... there's been a whole campaign to try to get AGRA and the donors to respond substantively and say, if our findings are wrong, show us. What do you got? What data can you provide that shows that we're wrong? We have it on confidence from someone who worked at AGRA that they have two internal commissioned evaluations from the last year that show that our findings are basically right. So we think they are withholding data that would probably not confirm all our findings, but not show them in a good light at all, not show AGRA in a good light at all. After the study came out, I wrote to AGRA and said to the person at AGRA who had come out with a very dismissive response to the study, and actually that included a personal attack on me as a researcher who has a bone to pick with AGRA. Like, I'm just biased. Not that it's based on fact or research or anything, but I said, look, you got to respond with substance. Here are the questions we need answered. He said, I'm not going to deal with you, basically. We're not collaborating with you. Three African organizations then wrote a letter to him saying, we demand responses. Good. And that's pending now. That's hanging out there for AGRA to have to respond to. There's Freedom of Information Act requests going out to try to get hold of those internal evaluation studies, which the U.S. government knows about. One of them was a midterm evaluation of AGRA strategy for the donors. USAID has put in $90 million into AGRA over the years. Our public money, our taxpayer money, has funded these things. And theoretically, we should be able to get access to evaluation documents. And we should also be able to ask the USAID officials who are working with AGRA, why are you still funding this if it's doing badly?
So have you ever seen foundations that have funded projects that didn't go well and admitted that there were problems?
Oh, yeah. In the nonprofit world, I mean, you know that funders know that not all their bets work out, that they're wrong sometimes, that their grantees were malicious or irresponsible. It's just that some things work and some things don't, but you evaluate it. Mm-hmm. You take the reporting seriously. You reevaluate your funding strategy.
In the medical community, for example, with drug trials, if something's going wrong and people are dying, they stop.
Right.
And in some ways, that's what's happening. People are starving. People are getting poorer.
Yeah. There should be regular accountability and not just to donors, but to the public, right? To African farmers. I mean, that's the thing. And frankly, to African governments, I don't know how well informed the African governments are that are participating, how well informed they are about this level of detail on what's working, what's not. I mean, one of the interesting things that we're, some allies in Africa are planning to sort of introduce a kind of transparency initiative within the African Union to demand that reports are disclosed and made available to the public. What will come out in that question is whether the African governments themselves are even getting these critical reports AGRA is doing about its work, and they might not be.
Okay, the last few minutes. Tim Wise is in charge. How would you run the program? What would you do to help these countries?
Well, the really good thing about what came out about the direction of African agriculture is that partly of the food crisis of 2007 and 8, there was a new attention to the importance of developing countries growing their own, more of their own food. This is the wrong way to do it. But African governments committed to increasing to 10% the amount of their total government outlays for agricultural development. That's a great thing. They haven't all achieved it. In the olden days, you may remember, not so old, comparative advantage, as dictated by the World Bank and the IMF, would tell you, don't grow, if you're not efficient at growing corn, don't grow corn because you can import it from us. And the food crisis kind of shut that down. So this commitment to agricultural development and government investment in it is a great thing. It's just being put in the wrong things. So a lot of African governments and farmers organizations have push them to reevaluate how they're spending that money and reorient it toward agroecology, toward agroforestry, toward soil building practices that can increase fertility over the long haul. They brag that a lot of their funding is going to small-scale farmers, but a lot of it goes to medium-scale commercial farmers and larger farmers. Make sure it's going to vulnerable farmers and make sure that it's supporting crop diversity, which is critical to soil health. but it's also critical to nutritional diversity, for particularly for small-scale farmers. There are a lot of, you'd call them pilot projects, that could be scaled up to do that. I mean, we quote in the report one sort of meta study by University of Essex researchers in the UK that looked at, I think it was 300 projects across 50 poor countries that were promoting sustainable agriculture in different forms, agroforestry, agroecology, a whole variety of different things. And they found, on average, the yield increase was 79% from those practices. Even for maize, its promoted crop has only, with all these subsidies, has only gotten 29% mm-hmm. yield increase in 12 years. For staple crops as a whole, nothing. The other thing they found, and this is where agricultural development, where the rubber meets the road for farmers, is it's not just about yield, it's about income and food security, right? And so they found in this study of sustainable agriculture that farmers' costs went down, not up. So the yields produced more food for them to eat, a diversity of food for them to eat, and greater incomes, because they weren't wasting the income that they got from selling crops on fertilizer, on inputs. There it is. That's what Agra says it wants to do. Yield increase, income increase, food security improvement, right there. The models are out there. They're actually being supported encouragingly by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations now, under a program called Scaling Up Agroecology. I think we're at an inflection point, and Africa certainly is. It's at a point where what we've said is the Green Revolution has proven it is failing to provide what Africa needs. Time to change course, time to take a different path, take Africa down a different path before it's too late and they're addicted to industrial inputs.
Okay, Tim, thank you so much for taking the time today to talk with me and share all of this valuable information. Thank you for your work and for contributing to this great report, False Promises, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. I'm going to link it to this post so people can read it and share it. It's very important. Take care.
Thank you so much for having me again. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Be well and keep working. Okay,
you too.
Thank you. Wow, everybody, that was Tim Wise, the senior advisor at IATP, Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. I hope you will take a moment to go to the links on this interview's page, where I refer you to the article that he wrote, as well as the report that he contributed to. Now, I'm here with Gary DiMattei.
You are. And, you know, I'm really concerned about you, because that was a heavy, heavy topic.
Yeah, and I feel the heavy topic.
And I can tell that your voice is feeling it. Your whole body is feeling this very heavy.
Well, the heavy part, aside from the fact that people are starving.
Right. Well, that's...
And people
and
are...
And this food, this is called It's All About Food. And so that breaks our collective hearts.
It does. But we have people who really believe, and I want to believe this, that they believe they're doing good. They believe they are helping. And somehow they don't see the truth. They don't see that they're not helping. They don't see that not only are they hurting farmers today, but they're hurting subsequent generations with the way their protocols are destroying the soil, diversity, health. Let's take Bill Gates, for example. I like to pride myself on asking questions to the people I'm interviewing that other people haven't asked. But the first question I asked him was, he said everybody's been asking him that ever since he started his Eating Tomorrow book tour. And that is, if Bill Gates is a smart guy, why is he promoting a program that is failing?
Yeah, the questions have to be asked. And how do you find the answer?
Well, I think the answer has to do with what you talk about when it comes to a vegan diet, how many people don't have the veil lifted. We've got blinders on, and we can only see so much. And I don't know Bill,
He should be on this program.
Well, I told Tim he should talk to Bill, but nobody apparently can touch Bill. He's untouchable. And someone like you, who's an actor and studies acting, you always want to know the motivation behind why people
Absolutely.
Are doing what they're doing. And Tim Wise said, as a researcher, he's not interested in the motivation. He's just interested in the facts.
Something is driving this type of activity. Something is driving people. Is it money? Is it greed? Is it power? Is it control over the little farmer?
Playing God, in a way. Perhaps Bill Gates, who I don't know. I want to believe that, as Tim Wise also said, he believes in technology. He also believes in corporations and wants to pair the two. And I want to say that I believe we can still use technology. We need technology. Technology can help these farmers. Technology in irrigation, for example. But maybe not in commercial seeds and synthetic fertilizers.
There's a real lack of compassion and a real lack of empathy going on out there for the farmers. Big, giant companies are continuing to squash them and control them.
Big may be better in some cases. I'm thinking more and more that big is never better. But
right.
Let's just give it a break. Big can be better in some cases. But when I think it comes to food production and farming, smaller is better. Keeping things within the community so people have easy access to food. We should be getting our nourishment from foods that are grown locally.
Getting back to your comment about motivation and objectives and why do people do what they do, there is always a reason why people do what they do. It's usually not the reason that they're telling you, you know, as it pertains to why they're doing it. And that's what we learn in acting school. That's what we learn when we break apart a character. There's an objective, there's a want and a need. A lot of people are pretty easy to figure out, and others are a lot more difficult to figure out. I think one of the things that is overly talked about, but for good reason, and you were talking about something earlier that triggered it in my mind, and that is what people believe. What people believe. Do they believe that this is helping? Do that they believe that? And I'll go even one better. How many of these people believe in love as a concept? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, even with your food choices, and I know I'm going to sound a little preachy like the vegan preacher that we often joke around about. Really, you have to give it its value. You have to look at how important love is in this equation, because there's an absence of love in a lot of these equations, an absence of love for one another, respect for one another, and compassion for one another, and all living things on the planet, including plants. I mean, we talk about the animals. So I think the system has been designed to deceive us. Like you opened with your discussion with me, the veil has to be lifted. You have to get woke, as some of my friends say. And hopefully this program can help people wake up a little to the fact that both sides, the left and the right and the middle,
I would like to think this is not political at all, what we're
right,
talking about.
Have to wake up and realize that what we're doing by slaughtering hundreds of thousands, millions of animals every day is not a sustainable way to feed the planet.
No, and this love extends to love for our planet, love for the soil,
love for
all of the microorganisms in the soil that we need to nurture.
Right.
That will, at least the microorganisms that benefit the soil and enable it to get the nutrients it needs so that plants can get the nutrients it needs so that when we eat the plants, we get the nutrients we need. There's so many things that are connected.
Right.
And we need to love all of those things. And when Big Ag and big corporations and Bill Gates come along and say we need technology and we need commercial seeds and we need synthetic fertilizers, they don't understand. And they can't be coming from, like you said, a place of love, a place from respect. Because it may feel great to play God. It may feel great to think you're really saving the world. But at some point, you have to realize some methods don't work.
No.
And this is one that doesn't.
Before there was a Bill Gates, how did these people survive?
Exactly.
You know, the Messiah coming in and saving these people, it's really kind of this power trip that, well, it's not kind of, it is.
So to me, it's just like history repeating itself.
Over and over again. Those of us that are woke can see clearer how easy it is to let all of that go and focus on what's really important. And
thanks for reminding me about love.
Thank you.
Because it's so easy to get bogged down, to hear the truth, hear these stories. Love is the lifeline. Let's wrap up our conversation about Tim Wise and his reports, which I think are really important. And I hope people do click on the links I'm offering so that you can read about what he's been researching. And now let's get back to what we love to do at Responsible Eating and Living Pandemic Headquarters, and that is make some happy, healthy, delicious food.
Oh, wow. You've been really busy in the kitchen. I mean, yesterday, again, you opened up the Responsible Eating and Living Kitchen, and you went to work on creating new recipes and a whole menu of French food. And tell us what you did, Karen. And it's all up on the website, and you worked very, very hard, as you always do here at Responsible Eating and Living Headquarters. And in addition to that, you made calls.
That's right. All right. I volunteer for the Biden-Harris campaign, and I'd like to put more time into it. I don't know how effective it is, but I'm making phone calls. Occasionally I get connected and I talk to people.
Which is a good point. I mean, goes along with what we're discussing. There's a lot of people who just are angry and hang up the phone and
they do
tell you to go do interesting things to yourself.
But occasionally when I do speak with someone, it's nice.
Right.
It's nice to connect.
Right.
And we don't always agree.
Right.
But it's nice to connect, and it's nice to say, I hope you enjoy your day.
And that's the other thing we were discussing, is when there is an absence of a compromise, when both sides can come together and compromise, they might have to give a little in both directions, but there is a compromise. When there's an absence of that, then we're in trouble.
Then it's over.
Then it's over.
Yeah, except right? That little seed of love.
Right.
That's
still there.
It's glowing.
That's not moving.
Yes.
And so that's what we got to grab onto during these times.
We got to grow that love.
Right.
Reach out and
touch
someone.
So when someone hangs up on you, or someone tells you to go fly a kite,
you just move on to the next call.
Right. You just move on to the next call, and you realize you send them love.
Exactly.
And
after
you hope
each
they
one,
find it.
It's easy to get demoralized, but I have to just like, okay, I wish them well. Next caller.
Right.
And then I go in the kitchen and make food. And you said I worked really hard, but I have to say, I love doing this. And there are times. Sometimes it happens in the middle of the night. I wake up, and sometimes it happens if I'm driving somewhere, but I start to think about recipes I need to make.
Right.
I don't know why it is, but I guess those are the creative juices.
I'm glad it was something that was whispering into your ear yesterday, because I was the beneficiary of your labor.
So I just decided I'm going to make French food all day. That was my thing. Now, of course, it's vegan food, but in the style of French cuisine. It started very easy with buckwheat crepes. We make these a lot. It's a fantastic recipe. I think it's easy. You fill it with fresh fruit, and then it's nice to have some things to drizzle on it. We very frequently make what I call peanut butter cream, which is kind of like tahini dressing, if you've ever made tahini dressing. You take a nut butter or seed butter, which is thick, and you add a little water to it, beat it with a fork, and then it's creamy. And I love peanut butter. But for me, sometimes peanut butter is a bit heavy, and I like to lighten it up a little bit.
Right.
So when I make a cream out of it, it's lighter, it goes further, I find it easier to digest, and then you can make it sweet or savory. So I put up the recipe for our peanut butter cream, which is sweet. It is sweetened with date paste. You may think that some of these recipes are complicated because I'm always calling on staples that we have in the house. And very often when I cook, I prepare things all at the same time. I am a multitasker. Now, some people say that's out of fashion and it may not be efficient, but I find it's like a dance. I'll be prepping one thing and then I'm thinking, oh, I could have this simmering on the stove while I'm doing that.
So we ordered 11 pounds of dates, organic, food to live. We are buying more foods in bulk. And I thought I would finish up the last round of dates that we had. And I just quickly pit them, put them in a pot, and add some water to them, heat them up, soften them up. When they're done, just whir it up with a turbo mixer, and you have, or you could put them in a blender, whatever, and you have date paste.
A turbo mixer is great, though. It's a great tool to have in your kitchen. I suggest everybody get one.
You know, we lived without one for a while, and it was difficult.
Right. Especially when you're dealing with things like whirring up dates in a pot. You don't want to transfer those into the blender, plastic blender.
All that hot stuff.
All that hot stuff. You want to let it cool off first so you don't get burned, but then just take the turbo mixer and
it's great with soup too, because you can cream up a little of the soup, leave it a little chunky if you like, or cream it
all. It's a great tool to have. I highly recommend. And we're not getting any kickback from the people who make turbo mixers. So
no, there's a lot of different brands.
Isn't it fun to go to our website? Because it's like, it's not like other websites. Our website doesn't have anything that it's trying to distract you with or sell you.
Yeah, we don't have
with little pop-ups and movies, and it's just crazy. Our website is like an oasis in the middle.
It's calm.
Yeah.
It's calm. Yeah. There's no like video running that you want to click and get rid of. Anyway,
keep going.
I make the buckwheat crepes, and so we have the date paste. I whip up the peanut butter cream. It all kind of comes together. We have cashew yogurt. Sometimes we buy it from foragers. Sometimes we make it ourselves. But there are things that are always here in the house, and then I like to build on them to make other things.
Right.
You can buy some of these ready-made products or make them at home. I personally prefer to make them and then have them. So we had these wonderful crepes for breakfast. And then later on in the day, I got on to my vision for dinner. And it was a vision. I wanted to make French onion soup. I wanted to make leeks with vinaigrette. And then I wanted to stuff something. And we had these wonderful red bell peppers. So I was going to stuff the red bell peppers. And I was really surprised at everything, how it came together. Now, for French onion soup.
Oh, that was amazing.
We had a lot of onions, which was one of the motivating factors between wanting to make the onion soup. But then I realized I need bread, and I had to make it.
Here's the part that's completely Karen Hartglass, everybody. Listen to this. What did you do when you needed bread?
I made it.
You made two loaves of beautiful gluten-free baguettes.
They're baguettes. I made them a little wider than a baguette because I wanted them to be wide enough to cover our crock soup bowls for the French onion soup.
Right, when you sliced it, yes.
And we have a lot of grains, which I like to keep in the freezer or the refrigerator so they don't go rancid.
Rancid!
You know, I make my own flours now. This is my new obsession. What didn't I have? I didn't have sorghum flour.
You had millet and oats.
Millet and oats, quinoa.
Quinoa.
And garbanzo beans. I haven't been able to get garbanzo bean flour. I do prefer buying garbanzo bean flour because the garbanzo beans are hard.
Right.
And I think they really give the Vitamix a hard time. It's not laughing at those beans.
Right.
But still, it can make the flour.
And the quinoa, to grind that was challenging as well, because you have to rinse quinoa.
Yeah, so quinoa isn't hard to grind, but I almost dumped it in with the other grains. And then I realized, oh, what about those saponins, that bitter flavor that you get if you don't rinse the quinoa. So I rinsed the quinoa. I try to get all the water off of it without really drying it. And then I ground it separately. It all worked out. And I made bread. And I made the French onion soup.
And it was delicious.
And it was amazing.
The French onion soup, I have tried vegan French onion soup many times, and I've failed each and every time to get that taste, that French onion soup taste. And you nailed it yesterday.
Merci, Gary.
You nailed it, Karen. I'm telling you, this is a great recipe. Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot to surprise me, and this was surprisingly good.
Thank you. So we use a 3-year-old barley miso from South River Miso.
Yeah, a lot of these folks that do these vegan onion soup recipes, they use bouillon, and packaged bouillon is questionable.
Yeah, there are many brands. Some are better than others.
Right.
You know, some bouillons can be okay. They could be food-based. And there's salt, and we need salt, and miso has salt. But I like to use the 3-year-old barley miso in a substitution for a beef stock, because
it's not necessarily a beef flavor, but it's a beefy flavor.
It's better.
It's strong. It's dark.
It's rich. And it's good.
And it's good.
And just to clarify what they mean by 3 year, it sits in a large wooden fermenting pot for 3 years.
Aged.
And again, we're not getting any kickbacks. We buy their product. That's it. But these people at South River make some amazing misos, and they will ship during the colder months. They won't ship during the summer.
And for those of you who don't want to have any gluten, barley contains gluten. South River Miso makes a number of gluten-free misos that are also very
just
good.
As rich, just as meaty, as Karen has said.
Yeah, so we're gonna have to wrap this up because we don't have much more time, but I want to also say that I made a stuffed bell pepper. We use our favorite grain mix, which is red rice, black rice, brown rice, and sometimes millet. And what was fun about it is you had made a cheesy sauce the night before for
a quick
our
sauce,
taco
yeah.
night.
Yeah, so this quick cheesy sauce is really fun. You just, if you have some cashew yogurt, you mix it with some nutritional yeast, a little squeeze of lemon juice, and some miso. And I use a blonde miso, a lighter colored miso for that. And if you want to make it look a little cheesy, you could add some turmeric and just whisk it up. That's a quick cheesy sauce. So you poured that cold sauce, that cold cheesy sauce, over the bell peppers and baked it all together.
Yeah.
It was really, really awesome.
Totally yum.
Yeah. And because of that grain mix that we have, it really does act like a meat substitute when you flavor it. And you flavored it really well, the grain mix. What did you use again?
I used Herbe de Provence.
Of course, because it was French.
Herbe de Provence, which is a mixture of herbs that typically grow in the Provence region of France.
Where you have lived.
Oui, c'est vrai. Basil, thyme, lavender, rosemary. It will vary what's in different brands and different varieties, but I like it a lot.
And you know we're making it better now because we're talking about things we love to do. Mm-hmm. And there's that word love again.
Hey, whenever I'm stressed, upset, for me, I need to
go
be
out
in the
and
kitchen.
Do something you love.
I cook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or go out and talk to somebody you love, or go out and hug somebody you love. Well, you can't really hug anybody today, but because of the coronavirus, but hug yourself.
Hug yourself. Exactly.
Hug yourself.
Anyway, I invite you to responsibleeatingandliving.com. You can see my recent blog post under What Vegans Eat, C'est Si Bon, French Vegan Cuisine. You can get the French onion soup recipe, the peanut butter cream recipe. And I finally put up our tortilla recipes for corn tortillas, sweet potato, and cassava flour tortillas, and my favorite, potato.
Yeah, you make those with Yukon Gold potatoes. They are fantastic. Well, not such a bad ending to a very dark and heavy subject. Well, thank you, Tim Wise.
Thank you, Tim Wise. But Gary, we are very lucky. To have access to wonderful food that so many people around the world have worked hard to produce and get it to our door.
We're very grateful and we love all of them for doing it and wish them well and hope they remain vigilant to their beliefs.
All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for caring. And please check out those links on this post for those reports by Steve Wise. Very important. Gary.
Karen.
Gary.
Karen. Have a delicious week. We'll be right back.